I want to tell you about something I've used and I truly believe in. Replayer. It's a sideline camera built for youth sports. Just set it up, hit record, and it captures the entire game automatically. No chasing the ball, no holding your phone, just hands-free, stress-free recording. The in-game tagging is one of my favorite features. One tap, and you can mark a big goal, ankle-breaking moves, or a clutch tackle. Then pull those clips for later for review, highlights, or social media. And the live streaming's next level. A buddy of mine actually watched his son's game while flying cross country at 30,000 feet. That blew me away. If you're a parent or coach at the field every weekend, Replayer is a game changer. Head to replayer.com. That's R-E-E-P-L-A-Y-E-R.com. And I think you'll be amazed. Hey soccer friends, I just want to give a shout out to our partner, TeamPlayer. They are changing the game on how you find the perfect soccer team for your player. Parents, this means no more endless social media scrolling to find information on teams. With TeamPlayer, everything you need to know is just a few clicks away. It's simple, straightforward, and lets you find the best coach and team for your player without any of the usual headaches. And coaches, we all know how tough it can be to get your team noticed, but when you subscribe to one of TeamPlayer's team plans, you instantly get access to set up an online team profile that allows you to reach more potential players and showcase what your team is all about. It's super easy and lets players and parents see why your team could be the right fit for them. And if you sign up using the promo code PITCH, you can try any team plan free for 1 month. So whether you're managing a team or searching for one, come on over to www.teamplayer.us. That is TeamPlayer.us. And come give TeamPlayer a look.
Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them.
And if you use the code PITCH, P-I-T-C-H, you can receive up to 10% off your next order. Hello, welcome back to Chat by the Pitch. This is Ian Babcock, your host. In today's episode, I am joined by Ted, the founder of Joy of the People, a nonprofit that challenges almost everything we think we know about youth soccer development. Ted shares his journey from a high-level coaching inside the traditional club system to walking away from it entirely to focus on free play, creativity, and what he describes as soccer being a language kids must acquire, not something adults can lecture into them. This conversation dives deep into the unstructured play matters, what kids learn in play that coaches can't teach, and why so many players are burning out before they even fall in love with the game. So let's start this chat and head to the pitch.
My name is Ted Creighton. I'm a soccer coach. I learned soccer at 16, which was not really unnormal, I guess you would say, at the time, because it was a time when soccer was just being introduced. And in Minnesota, most kids played three sports during the high school season. And so you had to go out for something. And I loved football, but I wanted to try soccer. It looked like fun. Had to learn everything step by step. Did well, played at a pretty good level, played it a long time at the very highest level. And then I went into coaching, but I didn't go into coaching until the 90s, I guess, mid-90s, when the youth soccer boom took off. And I always think that if I'd gotten a start earlier, I probably would have things would have been a lot different. But I was older and more mature when I first got into coaching, and I saw a lot of flaws or a lot of things that I didn't like. I became a director of coaching for a big club and immediately tried to down the competitive side of it while I was still inside the system of tryouts, elite teams, high performance player development. And that all came to an end in 2008 when the new wave of youth industrial sports complex came into town with ideas of if we could only create super clubs within the state or city, we could get all the best players together, play against the best competition with the best coaches. And the pressures of running a club became just, you know, that much higher. I looked around and I said, I don't know if I really want to bring my own kids up in this kind of environment. So I started with some friends who were like-minded, Joy of the People, which is a nonprofit focused on free play for kids. We started that in 2009. I've been doing it ever since. I can call myself whatever I want. I just like that term. And from the very beginning, we decided as a mission statement that we would look at things thoroughly and differently. When we installed free play, or when we tried to install free play, we really looked at what free play was supposed to be, what it was, what we thought it was going to be. And we argued a lot on how to implement it. And so it's been a very long process of watching, learning. When I started to see, I was a very experienced coach, very experienced. And I definitely spent my 10,000 hours coaching kids in gyms, fields, complexes, domes. So when I saw kids in play learning things that I could not teach them or did not teach them, I saw the poverty of the stimulus. It's an idea from Chomsky, which says that kids learn faster than their stimulus provides because kids aren't born to learn languages. It was like that, where I knew that they were learning things that I could not teach them or would not be able to teach them or no coach could teach them. And at that point, I understood that there was something in play. If I wanted to convince parents, leaders, kids, I had to understand play. And so I've been on a mission to figure out play learning, play development since that time. And we've run programs since 2009, including all-year programs in 2013-14. And we've developed some of the creative players that this state has ever seen. In doing so, have also had a great time doing it, which is, I think, we've never had a tryout, never cut a kid. We've had our ups and downs, but it's just been a great experience. And I think that what I'm most proud of is that the kids that have come through, they really have an attachment. They really have a connection with Joy of the People. It's really, truly a family. We have the oldest kids come back and play. The youngest kids get excited about the oldest kids. It's a big mix of just about everything that you like about youth sports.
There's a lot there to unpack and to dive into. You covered a lot of areas. So as you covered a lot of the questions I had starting off. So you were looking for a home looking through the philosophy of soccer. And our first conversation, I'm sorry to bring it up, but my train of thought has not stopped thinking about that conversation we had and how you talked about soccer as being a language and bringing it through and being submerged into it. And you're studying and watching these kids play, as you just said. And at what moment did you realize that, or did that all click for you as an individual watching this? Because we've talked about success and within the game.
Yeah, I think that's the jumping to the sort of the answer is, or the way to look at it is, my favorite TV show when I was growing up was Columbo. And in Columbo, the very first thing you saw was the murder. So you knew who did it. And the fun was trying to figure out how Columbo, our hero, is going to figure out this person did it. So as soccer coaches, we all know that play is like super important. Something like 73% of, there's been studies that show that huge numbers of pro players spent most of their time in unstructured play before 12. Unstructured play, street play, favela play, free play has been shown to develop the top kids, top players in the world. And people know that, but they just don't know how. So it's basically an inverse mystery. How can we figure this out? So as we watch kids, and we some real my buddies were really good players. We were watching these young kids grow up and we were like, what is happening? How is this working? We don't know. We have no clue. And one day I was researching video games. These video game designers were trying to figure out how to get kids hooked on the game. And what they were studying was something called second language learning theory, which is Stephen Krashen of USC's theory on how people pick up a second language. Now, the first language we pick up, nobody really knows how we learn it. We just learn it. And there's some theories that it's all about blank slate, behaviorist theories where it's all trial and error. Chomsky comes in and says, nah, kids are born with a language acquisition device in their brain that allows them to pick up spoken language faster than they can be taught it. But Krashen's innovation was, well, let's look at second language instead. Some people learn second languages really well. Some people really hard and never can be fluent at it. And what he found was that there was two periods that you went through to learn a language. One was acquisition, which is the love, the in and aroundness, the beauty of the language. It's sitting in the grandma's kitchen while she's cooking and listening to the Italian radio. Later comes the rules, laws, skills, and techniques, or the learning portion of the language. And at that point, I looked at it and I said, oh my God, we've been teaching soccer, including me, only with the rules, laws, skills, and techniques of the language and not allowing the acquisition period to occur in kids. At that point, I just saw a better way that I thought of teaching soccer that helped explain what play was doing. But then, and what was funny about it, the whole thing was Stephen Krashen and I had intersection. I went to USC as a freshman and had him as a linguistics teacher and remember the crazy guy running up and down the aisles telling stories about linguistics, which is, to me, was perhaps the most boring topic of all time. At the time, all I wanted to do was play soccer. I didn't want to study linguistics. Coming back around, I saw this is an incredible analogy or idea. And then he has five hypotheses. I don't want to go through them, but these hypotheses all match up with a better soccer learning environment that we were seeing in free play with these kids that we were developing at Joy of the People, playing futsal, playing outdoors, playing the grass, playing on inflatable courts, playing in all conditions, all kids together. The more I started to look into language learning theory, and of course, if you go to language learning theory, you run across the big name of Chomsky. He said that people are born with language. Okay, are they born to play? It started to look like it. All these theories came in and over. They started to overlap and we started to put together a theory that the game that when we train with coaches and in difficult environments, we're in the learning portion of learning a language, the rules, laws, skills, and techniques. But the real creativity, the genius of the game comes in the acquisition. So could we create more environments of acquisition? Fun, low stress, easily have locus of control, not the adults, encourage risk-taking, experimentation, friendly environments with friends, those kind of things. I don't want to get too deep into the language theory. I'm writing a book on it, but basically I think it's a new way to look at soccer learning, and it kind of like creates a balance point that I don't think many coaches are thinking about. A good example that I use in the book is Panenka, the famous guy who won the European Cup for Czechoslovakia. He is about to face off against Meyer, who at the time was considered the greatest goalkeeper of all time. So Meyer saves his shot. Germany's still in it. Panenka makes his shot. Czechoslovakia wins the European Championships. Big, big shot. So what does Panenka do? Panenka runs up to the ball. He basically physically tells Meyer, let's do this. He comes up to the ball. Meyer dives hard to his own left. Panenka softly puts it up the middle. Now, if a Martian came down to watch his first soccer game and was watching that game, the first question he would have asked was, what team is Meyer playing for? Because he looks like he's playing for Panenka's team, because Panenka told him to dive. The marshal would recognize that there was a language, a communication going on between what Panenka was shaping up to do and what Meyer did. And this is the sort of the gist of the language theory, is that there's a body language that is used to fake people, to tell your teammates, to move opponents around, is that Panenka used to move Meyer. And if a baby who doesn't understand language was sitting in that goal, he would have had a better chance of making that save than a well-trained, best-in-the-world goalkeeper. So how does that happen? If it's not language, you have to tell me what it is. So there's communication going on. To think of it as a spoken language would be a mistake. It's more of a sort of a embodied physical language where when we play, we send off signals. I'm going to 1-2 with you. I'm going to press you. I'm going to step over and make you think I'm going this way with a fake and go the other way. The language is very, very, very complex. The best way to learn a complex language is not to have a teacher, but to be immersed in it like you would in a country or in an immersion program at a school.
And looking at it from the parent perspective, the only way kids get putter is by doing these drills versus the cones, and not in a classroom setting, like you described, learning a language. It is sitting down, doing it over and over versus a cone, and until they get it right. And my favorite thing, I crack up every single time I go to a soccer field, a kid has beautiful ball control within 3 feet of themselves. They can't go forward, they can't go backwards, they can't go left, they can't go right. But you can ask them to do all these fancy foot skills within their 3-foot circle, but once their opponent on it, they lose the ball. And I get what you're saying with having them immersed in it. Yes, having that private lesson where it's all cone work does create the muscle memory, but it doesn't create the realism of the language of soccer. You could call it like you're describing it, which I find so fascinating. I know that, thank you for sharing that little bit, because I know you're having, like you said, you're writing a book on all this thing. So with that being said, do you find the philosophy, let's go start with the joy of the people, the foundation, take a step back and let's bring it back to what you're doing there. So tell me what joy of the people are doing and what they are trying to follow as a program to bring it to the masses at the end of the day, to your local communities, because I feel if you have a central hub, things get done much better.
It's an amazing location, amazing space, amazing partnership with the city of St. Paul. When I was with my earlier club, one of the biggest and most competitive clubs in the state, we formed a partnership with the city to get a rec center, a different rec center. And my plea to the board was, look, already get enough competition and training. What we need is more like play. And this place will provide that. We did it and it was the biggest failure of all time. The coaches didn't like it. The assistant directors didn't like it. No, the board members didn't like it. The kids were bored. The kids didn't know how to play. 16-year-old girls in a gym were just like goofing around, giggling. It didn't. And I saw it too. It was like, what is going on? Why can't they play? You know, so it just ended up to be a practice location setting again. The coaches started to chime in, hey, do a push-up every time there's turnover. And it just didn't, we didn't know enough about it. And I guess I was maybe over hopeful that it would be the magic solution. There was a lot of pressure on the club to get up and start winning more state cups and that kind of thing. So when I left that club, that is a good idea. I need to try to do it again. So I went to the city and said, is there another rec center? And they said, well, this other rec center is really, really nice, but we have other designs on it. And I kind of wedged my way in there with my friends and like did everything I could and went to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, community meetings. There was a final debate and everybody voted and we won the vote by a close margin. But and the next day we took over the rec center. We came up with the idea of if you put a pinprick in Minneapolis, St. Paul, it would be right in the dead center. It's in St. Paul, but it's like practically Minneapolis as well. So we thought it'll be on the light rail. It now is on the light rail. And we thought this can be a meeting place for the kids all across the metro for free play. We could just be the free play center. And that's what we did. We just went out for free play. We would do camps and programs, but 50% of our time was spent just free soccer. And a lot of kids came through. And then what happened was the next fall, there was a tryout, the tryout period for all the clubs. Every kid made their, after training for a year doing free play, every kid made their premier team that, you know, I can't believe I made it. And then we never saw those kids again. What happened was we were doing too good a job, allowing kids to play, accelerate them in their learning to another level. And then what happened was those kids didn't come back and we had to start all over. We thought, okay, we have to sort of get, some kids want to stay, not all, but some kids do. We have to provide programs for those kids. We started a year-long program. And that kind of was like the next booster rocket. Kids were happy to stay and play all year. So what we do is we bring in different age groups, sometimes mix them up a lot. And we just let them play for 2 hours a day, three times a week. We have a little bit of a team session if we're playing in a team format on Saturday. And then we'll try to play a game on Sunday. So in the winters, we play futsal. In the summers and spring and fall, we play outdoor. We just try to play on. I had a Brazilian mentor who said, you Americans are crazy in all your training devices, your speed training, you spend millions. Change the ball, change the surface. So we play with thousands of, probably the least played ball that we play with at Joy of the People is a regulation soccer ball. We play with volleyballs, futsals, Brazilian futsals, anything you can think of. And we try to make it fun. We play bare feet. We play with tennis shoes. We play with turf shoes. We play with cleats. We play on turf. We play on grass. We play on wet courts. We play outdoor futsal, indoor futsal. So we just try to increase the play and keep it fun. Also, best practices. We don't have the game to get, if it gets too crowded, you start to see it in the faces and the actions of the players. So then we'll reduce numbers. If it gets too sparse or too intense, players can get tired out too soon. We always played a big goals with goalies. We don't play to small goals. We've gotten rid of all our puck goals because we want that decision-making of keeper, finisher to be there. We look for overload and underload that we've come up with. Our kids are either overload, trying too hard, using too much physical force, brute force, grit, teeth grinding to get things done rather than slowing down, making it easier on themselves and their team, which is underloading and usually happens when they're having fun, when they're smiling, when they're enjoying themselves. It's a nonprofit. I probably get an email a week of how do I do this where I come from. We've looked into ideas and we're starting to pursue more of franchising. In the end, it's hard to monetize play, even though there's no such thing as free play. Sports are never free. There's always some kind of cost. If I'm providing free play at our center, for instance, which we do 1,500 hours a year, we are setting aside time that we could charge for. We have to pay rent. We have to pay lease. We have to pay for maintenance, ground maintenance on the inside, cleaning, a staff. All that stuff has to be paid for. How does it get paid for is a really, if I live in the city, live in Brazil and clear a jungle to create a mini, I've put work, effort, resources into doing that. So there are costs to almost everything. It's just a matter of making it more efficient, making it more player friendly.
Coming from Dallas, Texas, that's very hard to get true free play. As much as clubs try to do it, I see clubs are trying to do it more here. I think it's a response to some of the demand in the market, but to compete with, I don't know, some of these training academies that are just for individual player development. And it's very hard to get these clubs to buy into it because parents don't buy into it. They don't see progress just by running up and down the field. They don't see the soccer IQ building. They only see the intensity level being what it is. As a parent, I have a question regarding that because you talked about you try not to have too much interference with it all. How do you control, I don't know how to describe it, like how do I describe it? It is the energy level because I have a child that is very intense when it comes to soccer. He loves the game. He loves to play, but he gets super frustrated when kids don't take it as serious as he does. And it's funny because as a parent, because I know what he wants at the end of the day. And so maybe these kids' goals don't align with his end goals. So how do you control that type of environment for players that are maybe the end is at a different place? Because at the end of the day, you're trying to let them mentally figure it all out.
That is an amazing question. And it's something that we do see. One of the interesting things that I noticed, if we think back to those early days at my old club where we were trying with free play, you know, if I would ask those same 16-year-old girls to play at 101% intensity, they could have done it. And they may have enjoyed themselves. I'm not sure. Obviously, they were enjoying themselves because they stayed with the club. The issue is, what is best for kids? Kids will do almost anything we ask them. So when we first started doing free play at Joy of the People, we saw a mess. There's a lot in your question, so I'll try to go through it. But kids didn't really know how to play. Once, what we did was we brought in some older kids and we told them to play with them. And sort of there was a seating program. And we eventually saw an integration of the oldest kids leading the youngest kids. And when kids from, well, he's a pro now. This kid is a pro who is very, his dad is very, 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 very intense. And he came in and he brought in seven kids from his neighborhood, west, way west of the Twin Cities. And he said, I hear there's good free play here. And his kid was really young, 11 years old. He sits down and the kid's trying really, really hard, like 100%, like running everywhere. And like at the time, kids, including two or three that are now pro as well, were just toying with him because one, it was their environment. Two, it seemed kids who run at them and press and physical, and they knew how to like go around it. They were more experienced than this player. This player eventually went on and played even in Europe, but was always like a disappointment. And one, including one of the European coaches saying, look, he's a very good player, just lacks game intelligence, which is a hard thing to build. What does he do? He comes back to the Twin Cities and he goes to one of these isolated skills training programs. And they try to build game intelligence in him by, I don't know, shining a red and green light at him to decide whether he goes left or right. What we see is that kids who are over ambitious tend to struggle with free play because they've been giving rewards they've been rewarded for trying their best. But the play and trying your best are not the same things. When mice wrestle with each other, the more experienced mouse will let the younger one win about one in every four times, a gentleman's sweep. And the reason is they want to keep the game going. And the reason they want to keep the game going is to their love with learning. So learning for the player, the kid who enjoys play, is about unconscious acquisition of skills. The reward for the performer, the kid who went to Europe and had no game intelligence, the reward for them is performance. Did I win the game? Did we score more than the other person? Those kind of things. Kids who fall in love with explicit training programs and explicit rewards, you're in a danger of burning out. So we have to be extremely careful with them. And we would see that kids who from big clubs, like top clubs, U13, ECNL, Player of the Week, U.S. Men's National Team, U15 group, couldn't enjoy himself playing in the gym at Joy of the People because they do not enjoy playing. They only enjoy winning. But we did see after a while, the kids start to figure it out if they stayed long enough. So they would like, yeah, I get it. And look, all kids, when a kid is overloaded, let's say they're on some elite team, they like soccer because they like playing soccer, not working soccer. The coach asks them to work and the coach says, if you work hard enough, you will be rewarded. But what they really want to do is they want to play. And sometimes in those practices and trainings, they're playing, they're enjoying themselves. They're doing wall passes, one, twos, they're figuring things out. But is it enough? Is it randomized enough? Is it loose enough? Is it low anxiety environment enough? In order, over a long period of time, in order for that kid to eventually thrive and become fluent in the language, and then struggling with the language. So I don't know if that quite answers your question, but these clubs that you mentioned who are struggling with free play is similar to the problems I had when I was at my old club. The issue is the priority is not your U13 girls ECNL title. The priority is the girls enjoying soccer. And in order to do that, you need to make play a priority, not a vitamin that you take once a week on a Friday night for a Friday night free play. Friday night free plays, I love the fact that they're doing it. It'll never work. Monday through Saturday, they're just competing and overloading and doing all the, it's just not enough. And that's why it doesn't work, is they're not investing enough in it. And they don't invest enough in it because they don't believe in it, including the coaches.
That being said, do you think, I'm not going to break this down because I look at soccer, the more I have spent time learning about soccer, the more I have learned about other athletes and in general, they say the 10,000 hour rule. You need to be a master at your trait with 10,000 hours. And I will argue that now to the point of it's more than just playing, practicing. You need to be playing, you need to be watching, you need to be enjoying, because no matter what you're doing, if you're not enjoying it, you're not going to remember to do something. You don't get that dopamine effect from success, from doing a skill. I always joke, like, where do you think most of these players learn to do these skills that they do on the field? Is it in practice or at home playing, goofing around with a bunch of friends, having fun playing the game? And I talked to a sports psychologist and she told me, when you see the athletes have the most fun at training sessions is when they have the opportunity to create their own games, to create their own chances, and they take the biggest risks because nothing's on the line. And these are in professional training sessions. And when you start looking back to the kids, it's going back to that 10,000 hour rule. Do you think that 10,000 hours must be this uniformal training of doing headers a certain way, going through these motions? Or do you think majority of that time needs to be built up from this free play model? And as they understand the game, as they build that foundation, move into more of the structure format, maybe at the U14, U15 level, because that's when the FA model, I'm going to use the UK FA model where they talk about U11, U12 and under, you're training to train. So you're just going to practice to learn how to practice. U12 to U14, U15, you're training now to actually practice. And then when you get to U14, you're training now to win, because this is when it matters. This is when those people are starting to look at these players. Do you think, I look at DFW, we have it backwards. We want to win without building any of the beginning. And this is why we have high dropout rates at U13, U12, and it's getting earlier now because all the fun's being sucked out of it, even at the younger ages. And do you think that if we would actually follow those type of models and allow the free play to encourage it with a little bit of structure guidance, do you think we would have a better success with this versus the play, what is it? The play practice play model that the US soccer has set up, which is you come in, you play for a little bit, you do a little bit of a training session, and then you try to apply it in the last little bit. But each section is building upon each other. Do you think that the idea was great on paper and we are not applying it correctly, or are we skipping too many steps at the U14 and younger ages?
Hours matter, obviously, is born in steps on a soccer field. Being an expert soccer player, nobody raised in Mexico could step into Northern Greenland and speak Inuit. They just couldn't without being exposed to it. You mentioned watching, you know, maybe that's TV. I always say people that Pelé didn't watch that much TV. You know what I mean? Pelé watched his uncles play, his dad play. There was an acquisition period. So I started out as a big believer in the 10,000 hours. The guys who turned me on to it were, I was in Malmo in 1999 with a youth team from my old club. And they were saying, hey, there's this professor at Florida State University who's a big Malmo fan. So he called us and said, hey, I found out, I just discovered that it takes 10,000 hours of hard training in order to become an expert. And they pointed at this guy and they said, that guy is putting in the 10,000 hours. And I looked at this guy, tall guy who ran like he was knock-kneed. He looked like he ran Charlie Chaplin. And I thought, absolutely no way. 10,000 hours is a joke, because that guy is not going to be a soccer player. That guy was turned out to be Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And he was training there as a 17-year-old And then he went to Ajax and he scored that goal at Breda where he dribbled everybody. I go, maybe there is something to 10,000 hours. I started looking to it. I became the director of this club. I started implementing more time for all the kids, just like they were doing in Sweden, trying to fire up the kids to train more and harder. But then some articles came out on Zlatan later after he made it big. He's like, hey, I grew up in the Rosengard playgrounds and all I did all day was play. And he loved it. And he would like, well, we'd make up tricks. We put the ball through each other's legs. It was all about enjoyment, he said. And then the idea that and he also didn't come to Malmo until he was 15. And when I saw him, he was tall. He was 6'2", maybe 6'1". Already tall for a 17-year-old. Developed. He wasn't like a underdeveloped or late developer. Why wouldn't the Malmo coaches, why did they say 10,000 hours? Why would they? There's just no way. He was only there for 2 years when I saw him. So either they were making things up or they were adding those hours that he put in the playground as part of those hours. And that's, I have to thank those guys. That's what they were doing. They were like, yeah, he's played a lot. He's played 10,000 hours. He's played a lot. So now if you look at the 10,000 hours as maybe 5,000 hours of free play, 5,000 hours of work, you could look at it that way. And so when we started Joy of the People, that's how we looked at it. A lot of free play young. And then you like inch in the deliberate practice as they get older. And around 14, 15, there's a crossroads of where deliberate practice takes over free play. And I think that I used to believe in that. And then I started to see that we are getting way better results with just play. And also we stepped in to do any deliberate practice. It was very unnatural. It was very like coat top down. The kids were used to bottom up. Like, why don't we get to decide? We quickly stopped that and just let kids play. And then we worried, would they ever grow up? They would do things like, we went to one tournament in Iowa just for fun. They never passed the ball once. It was dribble, 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 dribble. And the parents called a meeting with us and said, is kids ever going to learn how to dribble or pass the ball? Are they ever going to learn to, are they just going to be selfish? Basically, they didn't say the word brats because they're their kids. But we all think about free play and we think, yeah, it's like, you're just going to develop how will kids learn? How will they self-correct? How will they self-organize? And the president, who is like my best friend, he stood up and he said, look, in theory, they will learn. My brother said, Gween Twee, when he was young, nobody worried that he didn't understand what the word green or tree meant, or that he wouldn't fix it. We just left it and he fixed it. And the same will happen with the kids. They will fix it themselves. And now what we see is that these kids, if they're allowed to play early, they fall behind. So if you had a tryout and we sent our kids there, they would be behind in passing skills, in listening to the coach skills, intensity skills, all these little skills that coaches like, you know what I mean? Do they listen? Do they nod yes? Do you know what I mean? They're just kids. They're kooky, crazy kids that are each very, very different. What we find, because we don't have tryouts, we have a big, 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 big mix. Some really, really experienced, some less experienced. And we tend to do really poorly in games and scrimmages at all ages, indoor and outdoor, up until about 15, 16. And then these kids start to take over. At 16, you can see a technical superiority compared to the other. They take people on. They're comfortable on the ball. What you don't see are very interesting as well. You don't see shouting at each other, pass the ball, get it off your foot, correcting mistakes. Why did you do that? You don't see that. They've been spending sometimes 10 years up to that point playing around with these mistakes. So yeah, they said it when they were 7, but they quickly learned not to say it anymore. And it's a very interesting progression. So I would say, to answer your question, I think the hours matter. Free play and acquisition period learning is more important and should be really protected. Very little or zero coaching until the age of peak height velocity, which is the moment, each kid's different, that their growing slows down a bit in mid-adolescence. 14 and a half average for girls, 15 and a half for boys. But you At first, we thought we should do it at 15 because that's the average. Then we saw that some of these kids are still wanting to play with the 8-year-olds. So now we let kids go and play where they want. Is the ones who are past that peak height velocity, they're like, Ted, I'm ready. And they want to go play with our top teams. The kids who aren't will say, no, I'm going to still stay here over here and play with the less experienced kids where I can control, I can underload, I can do whatever I want. We have the luxury of having a sort of a natural progression where we just allow kids to grow up and do what they want. Now, our men's futsal teams, U19 futsal teams, I think they've won 7 out of 8 state championships. They've won 2 national championships. The girls have never lost. The girls will lose every single game up to U15, 20-0, 10-0. But by 19, they haven't lost in 8 years. It's a very interesting progression that works for, remember, no cuts, no selection, no tryouts. I don't want to say it's like the perfect system, but this is a system that is more like a community club than it is like an elite club. It's more like everybody's involved. If you could imagine a small town where nobody can go anywhere, so everybody has to play every sport, everybody has to, you know, if little Maya doesn't come out for the team, you don't have enough players. So you got to get Maya to come out. It's that kind of thing. I think every person is counted on. Every person has a chance to develop. And I can also say that not everybody becomes at a pro level. But they all become a special person. They all surprise you in ways that you never could imagine.
That wraps up part one with Ted from Joy of the People. We covered why free play matters, how soccer functions as a language, and why so many development models skip the most important phase of learning, acquisition through play. In part two, we go even deeper. We break down small-sided games, overload versus underload, futsal, parental influences, and what needs to change if U.S. wants to move forward in the next 10 to 15 years. If this conversation makes you rethink how kids learn the game, you're not alone, and you won't want to miss the next one. Hey everyone, if you guys have enjoyed this podcast, have enjoyed what I've been trying to do, the messages that I'm putting out there, please give me some ratings, some stars on all the podcast sites that you listen to this on. Give me a review, share this, share with others. The more I can make this grow, the more I can continue doing this. I'm really trying to make a difference in our soccer community. So I hope you guys have enjoyed all this. And until next time, I'll see you at the pitch.